Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, those who are in the room and those who have joined us via Zoom. This is the second function we've had here at Terrace 47 on Phillip Street since the pandemic commenced early last year. And we've got Kevin Donnelly, who makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Last week we had Meredith Bergman and Nadia Wheatley talking on radicals, and today we've got Kevin Donnelly talking on things other than radicals, or possibly about radicals. So he's here on the occasion of the launch of his most recent book, Cancel Culture and the Left's Long March.
So cancel culture is a word, or an expression rather, that has become increasingly common over the last year or two. I mean, normally people talk about political correctness or being indoctrinated or left-wing propaganda, but or right-wing propaganda for that matter, but cancel culture has been an expression that is very much in the news over the last 12 months in particular. Now, whether it was Coon Cheese being labelled racist, Australia Day condemned as Invasion Day, Captain Cook's statue being defaced, Bill Leake, his son now Johannes, does very good cartoons for the paper, The Australian. But Bill Leake, you might remember, was vilified and attacked for telling the truth about, as he saw it, in terms of remote regional Indigenous communities. The latest example, and I mentioned briefly last week, was the revised national curriculum. And I'll just give you one example, and there are many, but time won't allow that. Students are now being told in history to study, quote, the impact of invasion, colonisation, dispossession of lands by Europeans on the First Nations peoples of Australia, such as frontier warfare, genocide, removal of land, relocation to protectorates, reserves, missions. It's what Geoffrey Blainey once called the black armband view of history. Now, I'd be the first to admit that after reading some biographies of Macquarie and Flinders, obviously circumnavigated Australia, after reading some of the history with the First Fleet in particular, and since, there have been examples, and we have to accept that it wasn't all roses, as we say. But what's happening now is the pendulum has swung so far to what I call the cultural left, or a black armband view, that I think we're in serious trouble. People talk about cancel culture, but it's vital to understand that it's only the most recent manifestation of what people call neo-Marxist ideology. And there's general agreement now that this neo-Marxist view involving critical literacy and the Long March can be traced back to the Frankfurt School in Germany during the early 20s. The Italian philosopher Augusto Donocci, and I'll quote from him, he argues the Frankfurt School embraced a revolutionary stance committed to liberation from authority, theological or human, transcendent or empirical. And Michael Gove, the conservative Member of Parliament in England, the American Roger Kimball, for two people, they point to this Frankfurt School as a tipping point, if you like, in terms of what is now called the culture wars, because instead of the Marxist approach of overthrowing capitalism by looking at the modes and means of production, it became a cultural war. So these academics started to realise that the revolution would never occur in the West. So if people were never going to storm the barricades, what was the most effective way to achieve what some see as a socialist utopia? And the argument from them is that it was actually, it can go back to Antonioni Gramsci, the Italian, in the prison notebooks, but more recently, during the 70s, Rudi Dutschke, the German student activist, talking about the Long March, the culture wars. So if you can infiltrate and take control of the media, schools, universities, even the church, family, over time you can achieve what the socialist or the cultural left sees as the abolition of capitalism, overthrowing the status quo, and arriving at this utopia, so-called. It's interesting that, and I'll just briefly mention, when you look at the theories or political philosophy behind this approach, one of them, and Gramsci really introduced this, is the idea of cultural hegemony. Althusser talked about the ideological state apparatus, and what they meant was that capitalist society can only reproduce itself by controlling how people think, by indoctrinating people. So their view is that capitalism has to be overthrown, and the way to do that is to take the Long March, as I said. And they also talk about false consciousness. So if you're actually happy working and being paid and raising a family, if you're happy being, as my wife was, giving up her teaching career to raise a family and to be a mother and a wife, then it's only false consciousness. If Julia, my wife, only realised that she was a victim of an oppressive, patriarchal, binary, Eurocentric system, she would understand what had really happened. Luckily, she didn't read this stuff back then, but anyway. In part due to the what I call the Cultural Revolution of the late 60s, and some of you, if you're old enough, might remember being at university back then when we stormed the admin. It was Woodstock, the music festival, Make Love Not War, moratoriums with Jim Cairns out there in Sydney and Melbourne. It was a great time to be alive, but as Wordsworth says, to be young was very heaven. It was a revolutionary period during the 60s and 70s. But if you combine neo-Marxism with the rise of theories like deconstruction, postmodernism, radical gender theory, feminism, post-colonialism, then you get a rainbow alliance of that coalesce. And what their intention is to overthrow the status quo, to mandate a new age of a Marxist, neo-Marxist utopia. So the targets are Western culture, Western civilization, Judeo-Christianity. Michael Gove, I mentioned, talks about identity politics coming to the fore. The idea of victimhood, identity politics. So people start identifying no longer, as Martin Luther King Jr. suggested, by the quality of their character, but people are now identified by their gender, race, whatever it might be. As somebody who taught for 18 years in schools and is now at a university, one of the things I found most depressing is that rationality and reason no longer apply. So it's no longer about logic or being empirical. And I'll give some examples of that in a moment. The idea of I think, therefore I am, has been replaced by I feel, therefore I'm right. So it's more about subjectivism, relativism. When I did the postgraduate work, I tried to read Foucault and Derrida and Roland Barthes and the idea that words have no inherent meaning, they're only signifiers, that how you interpret a text, whether it's Shakespeare or David Malouf, is up to you. There is no author, the author is dead. There is no objectivity in terms of what the text is saying. It's all subjective, it's all up to you. And worse, even worse, Camille Paglia, the American non-gendered, non-binary person, as she now calls herself, calls, and I'll quote from her, she says, an ethical chaos where intolerance masquerades as tolerance and where individual liberty is crushed by the tyranny of the group. And we've seen that again and again, I think, over the last 4 or 5 years, whether it was Bill Leak, whether it was Barry Weiss in New York, resigning from the New York Times, I think it was, for not being comfortable with her views. It's happening again and again. The interesting thing here is that I first wrote about cancel culture, or political correctness, over 26 years ago, when I went to America to a think tank conference, and there was a very funny dictionary of political correctness. And back in the day, you could laugh about it, in a sense that, you know, a manhole, you couldn't call it a manhole structure. It had to be a personnel structure, or whatever they called it. You were never drunk or intoxicated. You were chemically inconvenienced. Some of it was quite unusual. You couldn't be short or tall. You had to be vertically challenged or horizontally challenged. I mean, some of it is quite humorous at the time. And Bill Leak and Johannes often parody that and satirise it. But it's got to a stage now, if you criticise multiculturalism, as I have, you're attacked as xenophobic or racist. If you argue that marriage is between a man and a woman, as Margaret Court did, you're condemned as heteronormative, homophobic, and worst of all, Christian. And that's one of the things that troubles me as well, that now it's almost, and I'll use the expression fatwa, more generally, an attack against Christianity. And if you defend Western civilization, you're Eurocentric and a white supremacist. And the interesting thing here, if you go back to Geoffrey Blainey being run out of Melbourne Uni all those years ago, it's something that has been there for a fair while. Fred Hollows, for example, was condemned at the time, I think over 30 years ago, for suggesting that, well, I won't go into it, but he was in trouble as well. Jermaine Greer has been no-platformed for criticising transgenderism. Barry Humphries, we have the festival, comedy festival in Melbourne, and the best prize was the Barry Humphries Award. So that's been removed, abolished, because Barry, again, questioned transgenderism, and he argued a man would always be a man, or a woman would always be a woman. Other examples more recently, 200 academics argued that establishing a Ramsey Centre to study Western civilization would promote, quote, a conservative, culturally essentialist, Eurocentric vision. Universities now have diversity toolkits, safe spaces, trigger warnings to ensure woke students are protected and safeguarded. I mean, there are a multitude of examples. Moby Dick can't be studied, someone told me, in American colleges, because it's about killing whales. Conrad's Nigger of the Narcissus obviously can't be read, because look at the title. When I was raising my kids, I used to love reading them, Cinderella and Snow White. That is now verboten, because it privileges heteronormativity, which is about the love between a woman and a man. So society is riven with structural sexism. Women must have the freedom to go wherever they want, at whatever time of day, whatever the situation. And even Camille Paglia, the American feminist, disagrees with that, because she argues a man or a woman should not put themselves at risk. And if you're out at 3 or 4 in the morning and you've been drinking a bit too much and you're going through a secluded dark spot that you don't know, you'd have to be very careful, maybe you don't do it. Even last week, I think it was, in Sydney and Melbourne, boys were made to stand up in front of the school and apologise to the girls for being male. I mean, that's how far we've come. I'll give you two examples. One is, many of you would know Safe Schools, the gender fluidity program, arguing that gender is fluid and limitless. It was justified as anti-bullying, and what troubled me was Labor and Liberal governments, state and federal, funded it. But if you have read Ros Ward, who designed it, one of the designers, she argued at a socialist conference in Sydney, and I'll quote her, "Safe schools is not about bullying. It's about Marxism providing a theory and practice of genuine human liberation. Safe Schools is about supporting gender and sexual diversity, not about stopping bullying. And her argument is clear. You couldn't get a clearer statement about what the intention is. Other examples, generally as a result of the Black Lives Matter movement in America. The University of Leicester, Western science is now condemned as, quote, inherently white, and students are told science is a fundamental contributor to European imperialism and a major beneficiary of its injustices. Mm-hmm. So the argument is you don't study Western science anymore. At Sydney University, a number of academics argue that you can't study Western culture or civilization because, quote, it replicates and reinforces the concept of whiteness, leading to racism, sexism, classism, historical injustice, and prejudice based on religion. And these people are being paid by the taxpayer, as I said, under Labor and Liberal governments, to work in our universities. Now, I'll just finish with something Bob Santa Maria told me. Don't keep looking at the problem. Think about the solution. So what's to be done? I mean, there are a couple of points here. One is that we need to call out political correctness and have the courage to be true to our beliefs. And I'm happy to have a disagreement or a controversy or a debate or a discussion. But I think conservatives need to be a bit more forceful in articulating what it is that we value. I mean, I've been reading about the early settlement in Sydney and walked around just before and saw the obelisk and Macquarie there, where they, I think they use that to set the roads, the mileage out to outside into the, I won't call it the wilderness, because that's obviously, it wasn't a wilderness, it was people lived here, and we have to acknowledge that. The First Nations, as they're called, even though they were never nations, they were tribes, and in fact, they're guilty of cultural appropriation. I'm not sure if you know that, because it was the Canadian Indigenous people who started using that word, nation. So anyway, that's just a by the by. We have to call it out when we see it. We have to reassert the primacy of rational debate based on reason and logic. We need to mobilise like-minded people. I just gave a talk today at the Ramsey Centre for Western Civilization, and I'm very happy to be here tonight talking to you people. We need to get out there in the public square. The minute you vacate the public square and leave it to the opposition, you've lost the battle. It's as simple as that. And that's why I write for various newspapers and do TV. The other thing, we need to employ humour and irony and satire. I used to love teaching Jonathan Swift when I was a teacher in a school. And I'd read the kids Swift, his approach to say, well, what he couched as saving the Irish, the best way to stop the famine. And I used to read that to the Year 10 class, and it involved a heinous act of using babies, and I won't go into it, but it was appalling. It was satire, it was irony. Swift was making the point that the British government at the time was allowing thousands and thousands of people to die because of the famine. And so he took it to that degree where you think, oh my God, how could that happen? But in fact, it was happening. And so, you know, when I used to talk to Bill Leake and his son now, Johannes, satire and irony are very important. And interestingly enough, the last federal election, what Scott Morrison called the quiet Australians, everybody that I spoke to in the media and among political journalists thought that Labor would win. But when you look at north of Brisbane in terms of the swing towards the Liberal government and the Nationals, if you look at Western Sydney, parts of Melbourne, there was actually a bit of a turning point in the sense that people, and I still have a great belief in the Australian people, they generally have their feet on the ground. They want to get on with life. They don't like being indoctrinated or told what to think. So if you look at that result, I think it was quite good. And most recently, the ABC did a survey, Australia Talks, where 68% of those, and I'm talking ABC listeners and viewers, and you wouldn't think this, 68% of those people who were surveyed said they were fed up with political correctness. And 52 were Labor voters. And many of them were young. So my view is we have to call out what the issue is, cancel culture. That's the current description. But the challenge is to think, well, where did it come from? What's underpinning it? What's the purpose, the intention? We then need to call that out and to argue a counter case, if you believe that. I'm not saying everybody has to. We don't need an Orwellian situation of groupthink and language control. I'm a great believer in diversity of opinion. But if you do feel that it's the wrong way to go, you have to call it out, and you have to keep coming to events like this. Thank you.
As I said, Kevin's got a copy of his book, Cancel Culture and the Left's Long March, here for sale tonight. And also those who are not here and on Zoom and other places can purchase from your website.
That's right.
Which is?
KevinDonnelly.com.au.
KevinDonnelly.com.au.
Yep.
How about that?
Simple.
All right, so we come to questions and discussion. You mentioned it towards the end, Jonathan Swift, but as you know, Swift, Dean Swift as he was,
yeah,
in the Church of Ireland, died a rather unfulfilled and somewhat bitter, although very funny man, because he didn't believe that he should have got where he did get, and he was probably right. Now, if we did go back 50 years, what you're talking about today is cancel culture, but as you mentioned yourself, you go back to the 80s, you can go back to the 60s, there was a lot of time where anyone with a non-left-wing view couldn't get heard on a university or publish in a university newspaper or even publish in some of the main newspapers like The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. I think what's different now to what was different then is that people would censor someone, but they wouldn't demand that they lose their jobs for having unfashionable opinion. So where's the change? It seems to have come fairly recently that it's no longer that you're not allowed to give a talk, it's that you're no longer allowed to have a job, you're no longer allowed to involve yourself in the community. So what was the change there? That goes beyond what I think Adano and the guys in the Frankfurt School were talking about in the 20s.
I mean, it's a difficult question in some ways, but a good one. I quoted Camille Paglia and her argument that groupthink and language control became a tool or an instrument, not only to disagree with people, but to silence them. Now, whether it's Israel Folau not being able to play rugby, whether it's the argument that Barry Weiss, I mentioned, loses her job or has to resign. I think part of it is, and I've been thinking a bit about civility and courtesy and good manners, very old-fashioned ideas. But I can remember growing up as a kid all those years ago, and there was a strong sense of community, no matter where you lived or your background or whether you were privileged or not. There was a greater sense of civility and courtesy. Now, whether that came from, and I argue a lot of it does, came from Christianity, that if you argue that we are made in God's image and the inherent dignity of the person, that we should treat all with equal respect and dignity, we seem to have lost that. And now the argument is a lot more vicious in some ways. But the interesting thing now is what I call the cultural left are also now starting to eat their own. And to such a degree that even, and I didn't always agree with his policies, but President Obama came out, I think it was last year, and said it's time to stop all of this cancel culture and we need to get back to being able to debate openly and fairly. And I think there are over 100 academics and thinkers in America recently signed an open letter, Noam Chomsky being one of them, saying again that we need to get back to civility and respect. It's a difficult one, Jared, but I think part of it for me is not having Christianity as an underpinning.
Just stay there, but you're talking really about the Judeo-Christian impulse, aren't you?
Yeah.
Teaching, not... Yeah.
New Testament and the Old Testament.
So there's a question out there. I'll just take a question here. Ida Lichter asks, could the culture wars become violent or more violent than they are?
The short answer is yes. I mean, I talked about the fact that if there's no reason or rationality, and if words are simply signifiers that have no inherent meaning, and if whatever view you have is simply a factor of your race or gender or privilege, certainly how do you resolve discussion and debate? How do you resolve an issue? And either you're silent because there is no common ground, there is no meeting point. And you know, I talked about epistemological suicide the other day. That's one outcome, or else violence. And I think it was Pope John Paul talked about the fact that the socialist utopia has never eventuated. That if you go back to Lenin and Stalin, more recently Pol Pot in Cambodia or Mao, the reality is once you start denying the inherent dignity of the person and the ability to be rational and reasoned and to have that kind of common ground, then how do you decide a debate? And generally it can increasingly lead, and you only need to see that on social networking sites, which I'm not a part of to a degree, I keep away from it, but the vitriol and the poison. When I argued against same-sex marriage, I was abused as a pedophile, as a kiddie fiddler, as a, someone who murdered people. So that's the kind of vitriol that we face, and I'm not quite sure what the solution is there.
Say it, don't go away. There's a question down here. We've got plenty of questions. We've got plenty of time. Yes? Here, got it? Yep. If you got the microphone, you got the question.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay, thank you very much for your talk. It's fascinating. If we can go back a bit further than the 60s, back to about 90 years ago, where you saw Goebbels using, I guess, the ultra-right-wing version of wokeness, where you had revisionism, you had to change the culture. Do you see any difference between the ultra-right-wing version versus the ultra-left-wing version of cancel culture?
The end game, I think, is different, the end game. But the strategies and the techniques are similar. And if you look at Karl Popper, I think it is in Open Society, he makes the point that totalitarianism of the left or the right has been around for hundreds of years. And so it's not something that's recent. So I'd suggest when you talk about Goebbels and Hitler, he was a consummate media performer in terms of propaganda. George Orwell, when he writes about, you know, the Spanish Civil War and 1984, I think part of what Orwell is trying to tell us is that it can be from fascism or communism. And so I'm not... Certainly, I'm not suggesting it's only one-sided there.
Now, I've got a question from just a Jenny, and she's referring to your comments about Christianity, and she asks, why have church leaders not encouraged their congregations to speak out against this move against free speech, freedom of religion and religious thought?
Again, it depends on, I suppose, where you are in history. More recently, I'd suggest the whole issue of pedophilia, of the church being seen to be complicit. And I disagree with that in a lot of cases. I think the fact that Cardinal Pell, the High Court 7-0, said that that wasn't the case. But we have to understand that there were crimes committed. serious crimes against young people. And it's a great sin. It's evil. But because of that, more recently, I think some within the church are fearful about getting into the public square because of being attacked. I'd also have to say, and I won't say which religions, some have drunk of the Kool-Aid, as we say, and are more than happy to be very woke. So, I'm one with, I think it was Pope John Paul, who fought against, in Poland, against communism. I think the church, the Christian church in particular, should be more vocal in calling it out and arguing the case. Because my view is that there are many people out there, and you don't have to be a Christian to believe this, but there's a wide, increasingly, I think, widespread thirst for some kind of moral direction and some kind of spiritual direction. And you're not going to get that from the cultural left.
There's a question here.
I've identified several articles of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights that are being flagrantly violated by cancel culture, PC wokeness. Where are our leaders and the UN in calling this out?
Well, I was going to say, I think the UN is a lost cause. If you look at their committee, in terms of the committee that's supposed to protect human freedom and dignity, I think, you know, in the old days you had Saudi Arabia, Cuba, dictatorships in from Asia. So the UN, I wouldn't be putting my money on. I think the church, when I'm talking about the church, whether it's Anglican or Catholic or Jewish, you know, I think religious people have to, leaders have to stand up and start arguing the case. About 8-10 years ago in England, a group of religious leaders from different denominations put out a 12-point manifesto, if you like, about what the UK was in terms of its culture, its history, its spirituality. And it was a profound document because it argued very succinctly that things like common law, Magna Carta, have a strong Christian underpinning. Some of you may have read Sidentrop on the origins of liberty, and he traces a lot of this back to the New Testament. So if religious leaders, I'd be putting my money on religious leaders if they're willing. Politicians tend to not get involved, and we see that in Australia, where even a so-called conservative liberal government, apart from last week, I think Scott Morrison came out talking about some of these issues. But John Howard talked about the battle of ideas as years ago, but since then I think they've been missing in action.
Thanks, Kevin. Can you give us, if possible, some idea of when incursions were made into our educational system, left-wing incursions? First of all, the primary state schools funded system, I was a product of private school, and secondary, the tertiary education system. If possible, can you give us some idea? Because it became blatantly obvious to me 40 years ago at University of Sydney that Labor politics were very much the fore and they were very good at it.
Yeah.
But what about the primary school system?
Just on that point, Jennifer Oriel, who writes for The Australian, obviously, has written a chapter on universities, and she gives a detailed chapter and verse, historical sort of narrative about how it happened, when it happened. There's also a chapter on school education that touches on that.
Which is by you.
Yeah. I started I did dip ed, a BA dip ed at La Trobe. At the time, it was Maoist central, Marxist central. And that's widely acknowledged now that most of the lecturers and tutors. And the old style Marxists I liked, like Doug White and Bill Hannon, because they argued that the working class kids, migrant kids, had to learn. And that kind of goes back to Antonio Gramsci, who argued that the peasants had to learn algebra and physics and classics, because if you're going to win the revolution, you need to be articulate and intelligent. But there was a swing in universities during the late 70s early 80s, where education faculties lost the plot. And part of that was because of the Whitlam government getting rid of the colleges, teacher training colleges, and putting all of these people into universities. My daughter, and I shouldn't mention her because she's still teaching, but her course at Melbourne, none of her tutors or lecturers had ever taught in a school. So she's been taught to be a primary school teacher, and they're all academics involved with theory, but no practical knowledge or realistic understanding of what was happening in the classroom. So there are two issues there. One is the kind of cultural left influence, but the other is making teacher training, as I call it, too academic and too theoretical. I mean, one of the heroes, I think, of Australia over the last 15, 20 years, Pierre Ryckmans, who was a sinologist at the ANU and then Sydney. I mean, he wrote the Boyer Lectures, I think it was in the 80s. And back then he said universities are dead. And the only problem is the public hasn't quite understood it yet. And it's a great shame because there are so many young people, I still believe, have a thirst for knowledge and understanding, and they need a moral sense and they need to be culturally literate if they're going to be grounded. But they're going into schools as teachers and not having any sense of that.
Thank you. I agree with everything you've said, but it occurs to me, we could ask the question, why are we surprised? The kind of mindset that you describe is exactly the way human beings evolved for 200,000 years. Tribalism, hatred, simple ideas, epistemic certainty. We know what's right, we know what's wrong, you are the enemy, and we need to annihilate you. So the question then arises, is the Enlightenment mistaken about its assumptions of what human nature is really like? We talk about rationalism, we talk about realism, the search for truth, but it turns out that human brains haven't really been designed for that purpose. They've been designed for group survival, exactly the kind of thinking that you describe. And if this is the case, then the situation is far worse even than you describe, because we are living in this 200-300 years of unusual period when we managed to get away with this assumption that we are rational and realists, but we're not. And so perhaps what you describe could be the beginning of a return to our evolutionary patterns, which is tribalism, hatred, simplicity, and certainty. Do you think that could be the case?
I'm not an expert, but I started reading Karl Popper, The Open Society, and he differentiates, I think, between a civilized and an uncivilized societies. So he would suggest that Western civilization has actually improved the human state, so that he argues there is something there to acknowledge and celebrate in terms of the ability to work together and not to be primitive or uncivilized. And I get back to Siedentrop in his book on the origins of liberty, where he talks about the New Testament in particular and the word of Jesus about all being made in God's image. And he talks about what Rome and Greece was like in the day, very authoritarian, very patriarchal. There was no freedom. Slavery was common. And he talks about that what Jesus was teaching, you know, there is neither Jew nor Greek, and I've forgotten the rest of that, that parable. But I do believe, I'm optimistic, put it that way. I'm optimistic. And, you know, I read something years ago about Auschwitz and the Jews in the concentration camps and the loss of faith and the sense that, why are you doing this to us? But then I read Bettelheim, the American Bruno Bettelheim, and he sort of works through that issue, that it's not necessary to give up hope or faith. He still was in a way optimistic.
Question there? Yeah.
Thank you, Kim, for your comments. What you're describing is essentially playing defense or recovering lost ground. My question for you is, from where will come the alternative ideas? you quoted John Howard talking about the battle for ideas, but there seem to be no alternative ideas at the moment.
Yeah, it's interesting. There are, in America, for a while, I was a member of the Modern Scholars Association, which has been there for probably 40, 50 years. More recently, the Heterodox group. In England and America, maybe not as much in Australia, there is a movement away from, or a movement towards offering a critique, but also a solution, also a sense of what we need to do. You know, the Ramsey Centre, think tanks like what you have here. There's one Mankell Foundation in Perth. The IPA have a Centre for Western Civilization in Melbourne. My gut feeling is that it's not over and it's not going to be an easy battle. But more and more people are beginning to argue the case. Jordan Peterson being a good example, who must have hundreds of thousands, if not millions of hits over the last 4 or 5 years, where people are going on social networking sites now. And, you know, someone said to me the other day, why write a book or why edit a book? Because most people won't read a book. They'll go on social networking. And whether it's YouTube, John Anderson is doing a great series of YouTube interviews with people from around the world. So there are little spot fires, if I can put it that way, that are starting up, and I'm optimistic.
So where are we going? John, we'll, no, Anne, we'll go with you, and then we'll go with John. Can I just make one point? Those on Zoom, you can send in your text messages if you want to ask a question, Anne.
I just want to make an observation. It's from looking at a granddaughter who was 21 doing arts at Sydney University, is a vegan, about as left of centre as anyone can get, who gave up her arts degree at Sydney because it was full of a load of codswallop, but even she, with the most vegan and green left views, knew it was rubbish. Mm. She's now turning to be a primary teacher. Now, she may end up with a load of left rubbish, but she'll also end up with a practical sense of what she wants to do. And that's my answer to perhaps what you were saying about being optimistic. They'll eat themselves.
When I taught at Camberwell Grammar School in Melbourne, a very good headmaster, an old-style headmaster from Scotland, Edinburgh, Colin Black, he always said the left have got it totally wrong, cultural left, because if you're indoctrinating all these kids, when they get to 14 or 16 or 17, they'll react against it, because that's the nature of adolescence. You know, you're wrong, Dad, you're wrong, Mum, and the teachers are certainly wrong. And that was an interesting observation. But one of the surveys last year looked at millennials in Australia, and a significant number of millennials were totally against political correctness. And they said they were fearful about speaking out, and that was wrong.
No, John, hook here.
As a teenager, the importance of freedom of speech was brought out by the Catholic Church's treatment of Galileo and Copernicus. And so it's been an important part of our development and a very important human right. Where does that leave our Human Rights and Equal Opportunities Commission in defending this important right? Because it seems to me that from what I can see of some of the famous or infamous cases, that they're actually attacking it. And what's their attitude to this cancel culture?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert in that area, but one of the things I've worked out over the last 40 years is that conservative governments are not very good at appointing people or placing people in positions where they can exert influence and control. The left, on the other hand, regularly put their own people up for all these positions on different tribunals and different bodies. ACARA, which is the national body responsible for the curriculum and for NAPLAN, the assessment regime, it's awash with people who are what I call educrats, who have never taught in a classroom, know nothing about the curriculum, but are self-serving and like the old Industrial Relations Club, there's a clique. And Labor and Liberal governments tend to leave them alone and let them get on with it. I mean, to me, it's an appalling indictment that governments of both political persuasions have taken their eye off the ball, as it were. And I know when I was working in Canberra as the Chief of Staff, the education wasn't seen as an advance. You know, if you want advancement, you didn't get education as a portfolio. You got something like Treasury or Trade or whatever it might be, Defence. So education, Labor or Liberal, governments tend to not take control. I mean, that's why I'm a great believer in subsidiarity. And I think it was Hayek, you know, the road to serfdom, that you try and get power residing at the level where people are most affected by it and most able to make decisions. So I'm a great believer in Catholic and independent schools and being able to have that autonomy. I'm not a great believer in bureaucracies and I said to John Howard and, you know, all those years ago, don't have a national curriculum. Because once you centralise it, you've lost the fight.
Question down the back.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm referring to the late Harold Bloom of Yale, the literary critic, and he referred to the School of Resentment. And he refused to apologise for his own positions, but he also refused to present an apologia for either the left or the right. And I guess I find myself in that middle position. And I wonder to what extent are the left and right an echo chamber that's not, you know, they're fighting with each other while the rest of us are just sort of sitting back going, you know, we can see elements of truth on both sides, but it's so far removed from reality. I guess, what does it mean for those of us who are neither Labor nor Conservative and tend to be more small L liberal in this sort of space? And, what does it mean to us, I guess, this culture war? Thank you.
I mean, that's a very good question. I was talking to Tony Abbott today over lunch, and one of the things I said was, you know, Sky News, the Murdoch Press, who I write for, whether it's the ABC or the old Fairfax Press, they're kind of in an echo chamber where they're talking to their own people, the true believers of either, you know, left or right. That is a danger because you get a debate which is not reaching any commonality or any sense of progressing to something that hopefully might be a solution to these issues. But at the same time, you know, John Howard, as Prime Minister, always said you have to keep in touch with your base. And I mentioned the last federal election. I wrote a couple of articles about the ALP Green policies on gender fluidity and all the rest of it. And that resonated with a lot of those electorates, certainly north of Brisbane. And to my mind, that swung the election or helped to. So you have to call it out when you see it according to your convictions and beliefs. But you should do it in such a way that it's willing to engage in respectful dialogue and conversation rather than just being, accusing and vilifying people. So I agree with you. But, the number of parents I had phone calls and emails when there was the article in the Herald Sun and the Daily Telegraph about boys being made to stand up and apologise to the girls for being boys, suddenly a lot of parents understood this has gone too far.
But here your argument's not really with Labour, is it? It's with the Green left. Because, as you know, there's a very strong social democratic tradition in the Labour Party which would be in agreement with a lot of what you say.
True.
On social issues, maybe not economic issues, but... So how does... That voice has gone more silent than it used to be as well, hasn't it? The social democratic voice.
It has, and you'll be able to correct me. Was it Crean or Beazley Senior who said many years ago that, you know, the workers, the Labour Party no longer respects the workers. It's been taken over. I think he used the expression the dregs of the middle class. But
Kim Beazley Senior.
It was a good quote.
What is very noticeable is the way that the corporate and professional worlds concede all the time. They fall over like a row of tents to the slightest blow from the woke brigade and concede everything. To what do you attribute this taking the knee to every woke fashion?
I think two things. Profit. Profit's a great motivator. I think it was Richo who said, you know, always back the horse that was going to win. Self-interest.
It was Jack Lang.
Richo
pitched
used
it from Jack.
Oh, he stole it. Richo stole it. There you go. So self-interest and profit is one thing. But also talking to young people, graduates, who are like in their late 20s, early 30s, a lot of them are woke, have taken the Kool-Aid. So businesses and corporations have to meet the needs of those employees. So that's part of it as well, that if they want their employees to be comfortable and to be motivated and to turn up at work every day, they have to do all of this stuff about sensitivity training and, you know, consent training and have, you know, the whole rigmarole.
Now we've got a question here from a very learned Zoom follower down in Canberra, refers to Yuri Bezmenov and asks, was he correct when he made a similar argument 40 years ago? Have you ever heard of him?
Nope.
Okay, well he was a Soviet journalist who did a bunk to Canada. And he obviously has impressed someone in Canberra. That's who he is.
Wonderful.
Wonderful. Here we go. Hang on a second.
Yeah. I think it was Robert Conquest who said that institutions which are not explicitly conservative end up being taken over by the left. I'm just sort of paraphrasing, I believe, what he said. Does the implication possibly follow that institutions, many of the institutions such as the ABC and others, may in fact end up being unreformable and perhaps need to be either broken up, abolished, or what have you?
Yes. The short answer.
Yes.
I mean, when I reviewed the national curriculum in 2014, I co-chaired that review. Ken Wiltshire and I went around, Australia, and met all the bureaucrats and the curriculum people. And I wrote an article back in the day and I said the quickest way to resolve this problem is to shut down ACARA, shut down AITSL, which is the other body, devolve it. You maybe have a little group of 15 or 20 people who monitor and evaluate and make sure that what's happening isn't totally wacky, but get rid of the bureaucracy. They're self-serving. As I said, they're like the old Industrial Relations Club. I mean, I would be suggesting in education, which is my, you know, career and my experience in schools, to try and get a greater sense of subsidiarity. I mean, we've got government schools, Catholic schools, independent schools. In the independent, you've got Montessori, you've got Steiner. You've got a range of different philosophical educational approaches. I mean, you need a sense of ensuring that what is happening is reasonable and fair. But in that sense, you know, without upsetting anyone, I'd let the market work.
But hang on a minute. I did a column in the Weekend Australian a couple of months ago and I expressed concern about what's being taught in government schools. I got a friendly and complimentary but critical email from a bloke in Melbourne called Donnelly who said this was just as bad in private schools.
True.
And I acknowledged that you were correct. So
yep.
There's a problem in private or non-government as well as government schools, right?
Absolutely. And part of the problem is the national curriculum and then the various state and territory equivalent documents are often mandated. So independent schools. The other problem is teacher training, because the teachers have gone through a process of, unlike I had when I was doing DPED and at La Trobe all those years ago, they're only ever getting one side of the story. But I'm still a great believer in subsidiarity in the market. And increasingly, you know, I get emails from people who are homeschooling, especially in Queensland and rural regional New South Wales. And the penny's beginning to drop. A lot of parents are now understanding of about what's happening in the schools, and whether that leads to any real change, only time will tell.
Many thanks. I think that's a good spot to end. So, thanks for Kevin for sharing his views today on council culture. And as I mentioned, copies of the book here with articles and by Peter Credlin and Jennifer Oriel and Kevin himself and Tony Abbott and Anthony Dillon and others. So. So you've been here before, and no doubt you'll come back again, but thanks for a lively presentation tonight, and a lot of questions. My pleasure. Thank you. Thanks, folks, and thanks to all of you out there in Zoom land.